Well, good.
Since you have your calculator handy, that same protein wheat is about the same here. Today, we can round it off to 5. It's been about 490. But just round it off at 5, and then divide that into... similar car would be 35,000, 38.
That's not
a luxury car, but even if you went to 40,
well, this same $660 was the same price they quoted on a Chevrolet.
Yeah. So, and a Chevrolet of that size today is in that 35, and
you'd have to buy a Suburban to get a Chevrolet of that size today.
Well, that's true, but but just for a family car, skip the all-wheel drive and the, you know, the sport utility and all that. Just do it at 35,000, and see how many bushels it takes.
Well, what's the price of wheat today?
Just figured at 5 here. That's the
$5. Okay.
Yep, $5.
So we got 26 acres here. So okay. So we got $35,000 divided by $5 is 7,000 bushels of wheat.
And the yield here, we can call it at 40. Not, but we can call
right.
It up.
That's 175 acres.
That's a significant difference from 26.
Between 26 and 175.
That reflects the population decline in every small town in America.
And this is progress, Tom. This is progress.
I know that.
What we're talking
talking about here, Sue, I want you to hear this, because we're talking about the purchasing power of money.
Yes, I was very interested in the calculations.
Yeah, what I've got here, I received from one of our Norm members, Mike Brosa of California, who grows organic rice for a living. He sent me a copy of Fortune magazine. You've seen Fortune magazine, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, when I was a kid, I remember it.
Okay. This was published in February of 1940.
Mm.
I'd have to get out my tape measure to tell you how big this magazine is. Because it's larger than 8.5 by 11.
Like those old Look or Life magazines?
Oh, it's at least that size, and it is 3/4 of an inch thick.
A lot of advertising in there.
That's what they're all about. It is 14 inches from top to bottom. And it is 11 and a half inches wide. And 3/4 of an inch thick. $1 a copy. Anyway, so we were going through some of the advertising in here. There's an ad for a Chevrolet here for $660. So we converted the price of a new Chevrolet at $660 into the February 1940 sale price of wheat and the 1940 yield of wheat per acre, and found out that on average it would have taken 26 acres of wheat to buy that Chevrolet at $660. And then we translated that into today, where a Chevrolet costs $35,000 at current prices, $5, and at current yields of probably 40 bushels or 50 bushels an acre, what we figure, I forget.
40, I think.
And found out that that would take 175 acres of wheat to buy the Chevrolet today.
So when I was looking for my car, my first car ever, I was out of high school, and I bought a secondhand car. But I looked to see what a regular Chevy cost. This was in 1969. Wait a minute. When did I go to high school? Oh boy. I graduated in 64. So that means, yeah, so around 1965, I got my first full-time job, and I needed a car to get to it, and I bought a secondhand car, but I went to look for what a Chevy cost. It was $2,000 then. 1965 was $2,000.
How old was the car?
The $2,000 was for a Chevy, new Chevy.
Oh, a new Chevy. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right. You know, just the regular, no bells and whistles, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Oh, I see. Oh, when you bought the used one, you priced the new one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, my first car I spent $400 to buy. It was used.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
My first car I got was when I was in sophomore, junior in high school, and it cost $15. It cost $15, about a $15 car that didn't run is why it was cheap, but I spent $50. It was a 59 Plymouth station wagon.
Well, you know, my first car had a hole in the bottom of the, you know, when you drove it, there was a hole in the bottom of the floor.
I had one of those, too. That was a Triumph TR3 that had a hole in the bottom of it. In the wintertime, in mud puddles, it was not fun.
That's right.
I graduated the same year, 64. I bought a brand new 66 Mustang, ordered it, candy apple red with the 4-speed to 289, cost $2,800 sitting on the showroom floor.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a good car. But it's all, you know, there isn't a more accurate measurement because motor vehicles are a part of our daily life. That's how Americans transport ourselves around.
Yep.
And the purchasing power of what's being produced is a damned important number.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that throws out the efficiency nonsense and the comparative advantage. All that stuff disappears right inside that set of numbers.
Well, let's look at what Sue did there as far as 1965. We'll take the, I think I've got the price of wheat there. 1965.
Wasn't very good. Would have been under $2, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it was probably, well, I guess the annual average is over here on the right, $1.35. So
it had collapsed.
$2,000 for the car divided by $1.35, which is the, how many? That gives us 1,482 bushels of wheat.
Oh my goodness. Oh, but how many acres is that? But how many acres is that, right?
Well, at the yield in 1965, it was probably, 45 bushels?
I suppose in the, your part of the world.
Right, yeah. By 45 bushels. Which would take 33 acres of wheat. And that means that those 33 acres of wheat did not pay the taxes on 33 acres, did not pay the farmer 33 acres worth of anything. He just took all the gross money he got from 33 acres and bought a car with it.
Mm-hmm.
And depended on all the rest of his farm to cover his taxes and his food and his electric bill, gas bill, and everything else.
Well, this is a demonstration that a bigger truck is not an answer.
Well, then compare it to what the number we worked up earlier, 1940, where it only took 26 acres of wheat to buy a Chevrolet.
Yeah, well, what I'm saying is you can't get a big enough truck.
And I may be off on the yields there.
To me, that's almost immaterial.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the yields, because they're also variable from out here in the Great Plains, you know, to Iowa and Illinois, Michigan, Indiana, or Washington State. But it's all relevant.
I do have yield information in one of these spreadsheets. Whether it goes back to 1940 or not, I'm not sure, but I've got yield stuff someplace.
Well, the Green Revolution really didn't get cranked up until the late 50s. You know, it got really serious. Norman Borlaug's work with wheat that changed the
right,
yields.
Yep, yep.
You know, incredibly.
Well, when did they start? When did the the fertilizers and the chemicals come in? Wasn't that the 40s?
Oh no,
late,
it was
late 40s, early 50s.
Well, in a industrial way, yes, but those began to be used around the turn of the century, the 19th or the 20th century, around 1900. Fertilizer became a significant contribution to agricultural operations back in, you know, the teens and the 10, aughts, teens, and 20s of the 20th century.
That was the nitrogen fertilizers?
Yes.
Hmm.
Yeah, because that was what that was the essence of the Henry Ford proposal that wound up in Tom Edison's proposed amendment in 1922 to the Federal Reserve Act, was that the President of the United States had put an ad in the New York Times asking for somebody to come finish the development of the Muscle Shoals project. That was after World War I, 1918-1919.
And Muscle Shoals, what was happening there?
What was happening was that the intention to hello.
Hi, this is Wendell.
Hey, Wendell.
Hello.
The intention to try to make the Tennessee River navigable through the Muscle Shoals area resulted in the development. They had to dredge the river. It was shoals. It was shallow water. And they couldn't get a shallow draft boat even up through the shoals. So the intent was to try to channel the river and develop hydropower, although there wasn't much of a fall there. And what they did was they built nitrogen processing or nitrate plants as fertilizer. And during World War I, those nitrate houses were converted from nitrogen fertilizer to munitions.
Oh.
And following the war, what happened, the federal government just stopped its wartime spending. They just quit writing checks for munitions. And so that area, the nitrate houses, were all closed down because the munitions money stopped. And so the President of the United States put an ad in the New York Times, said, who will finish this development for us?
Then, Randy, what was the woman in around 1960 wrote Silent Spring? What was that in a reaction to?
Rachel Carson? That was in reaction to DDT.
Oh. Oh. Wow.
You remember Joni Mitchell, hey farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. You're saving your crops, but you're killing the birds and the bees now.
Oh.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone?
Oh.
They paved paradise and put up a parking lot.
Huh. Wow.
I don't know, it could have come out last year. The DDT could have been dicamba.
Very much so, yeah.
Well, just because it's a new year, I need to remind Mr. Cook that I'm looking at a picture here of one of his fellow Michiganders.
Oh, my.
Uh-huh. And the quote is...
Brochure.
The quote is from this Michigander, so come to that realization, there are rabid coyotes running around. You don't wait till you see one to go get your gun. Keep your gun handy, and every time you see one, you shoot him. And he's referring to liberals, Democrats, rhinos, and Hollywood types.
I know who that is. I know who's that.
Yes.
I do. The Motor City Madman.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And he's certainly right about rabid coyotes.
Uh-huh.
But I know, you know, rabid
although
coyotes.
Although you should wait to see the one
rabid
before you shoot it.
Well, you know, but rabid coyotes don't know there is one.
No, but you should wait to see them before you shoot them.
Well, I don't think Ted has heard that. So, and I just wanted to rub that in, that he's a Michigander.
Yes, yes, yes.
We have our own nut jobs here. I can tell you, you're competitive.
You're proud of them, I'm sure.
Yes, you're right.
Uh-huh.
was having a lot of fun reading this. It's February 1940 thing. They've done the whole issue is their 10th anniversary issue. And what they have done is they took a survey. But it's just a really obnoxious advertisement, a two-page spread. It says, babies begin life on dextrose sugar.
What do they mean?
You want me to read the whole thing to you? Here it goes. Human life begins at conception. Suddenly, after a period of preparedness, birth delivers the baby for independent existence. Somehow, the shock seems ill-placed after 9 months of protectiveness. His conscious state is disturbed, his body temperature diminished, his sensitivity exaggerated, his tissue acidotic. To overcome these birth disturbances, various dextrose solutions have been devised as the first feeding to be offered. Hello.
Hi, Bruce.
Hey, Bruce.
Hi.
Dextrose helps alleviate birth shock and prepares the baby for individualized living. At birth, quote, nothing is, all is becoming, close quote, and the years which follow birth form a continuation of fetal life. After birth, no new structure or organ is laid down, but tissue cells continue to divide and grow and develop into maturity. Superior infant feeding accelerates maturation. Whether the baby is breast or formula-fed, he must be provided with the 50 nutrients essential for life, and these must be properly adapted to his digestive capacity. The infant's nutritional requirements are usually met by the use of simple mixtures of milk, water, and sugar. Milk alone does not provide enough carbohydrate to fulfill the baby's needs, hence the addition of sugar. Whatever the type of sugar added, it either contains dextrose or yields dextrose on digestion. Dextrose is thus the fundamental food energy sugar that composes directly or indirectly the first feedings of the infant. Incidentally, it was the dextrose and dextrose-forming sugars of Karo, K-A-R-O, which attracted this well-known table syrup to the attention of the medical profession as a valuable component of infant feeding formulas. Food industries are invited to investigate merits of dextrose. Soft drink bottlers, bakers, confectioners, ice cream manufacturers, meat packers, fruit and vegetable packers, and others among the great industries which use dextrose sugar to advantage. Other industries may find that dextrose improves food flavors, textures, keeping qualities, and other desirable characteristics of their products. The inclusion of dextrose as an ingredient of a processed food provides the manufacturer with a new sales argument. The featuring of this fact on the label often captures public preference. Incidentally, dextrose frequently lowers production costs. Dextrose is not a copyrighted name. It is a generic term for a type of sugar, just as maltose, lactose, sucrose, etc. describe other type sugars. Manufacturers are invited to investigate the merits of dextrose and discover how to use it to advantage. Technical advice will be rendered without cost or obligation. Just write to Corn Products Refining Company, one of the producers of Pure Dextrose, 17 Battery Place, New York, New York. The town so nice they named it twice. No, they didn't. I'm sorry, I was ad-libbing at the end there.
Because that was done in 1940 and my parents followed that advice, that there is now proof, that you're holding proof in your hands, I could sue them for my health problems today.
There you go. I could sue them for my bad teeth.
Yeah, I think...
Ironically, I have seen the recipe where they use Karo syrup
for infant formula.
Yes.
And there was a whole generation of women that just, why, you know, my mother preached it, me and my wife, well, they don't get enough by breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. Ironically, science, and it was nothing, you know, because they're not capable of doing this kind of science in this country.
Right.
This was done in Russia. That when any mammal is born, just prior to the cord being snapped, the baby sends stem cells back to the mother, so she will custom tailor the milk for that newborn, for nutrients and elements that the baby needs.
Yes,
now, I don't think you could come up with a better way to do that.
That's correct.
But I could that very much, by
forgot.
Looking at Congress, see what happens when you feed them formula.
Well, I think somewhere along the line they forgot the meaning of the term mammal. And we seem to have gotten along for several thousand years without those scientists and corn syrup.
Well, I know they tried to give sugar syrup to my oldest son when he was born in the hospital, and he spit it up on him. That would probably be the worst possible thing you could give an infant.
You mean the hospitals were giving it to?
Yeah, they tried to give it to him. You know?
Yes, that was just common in the 50s and 60s. Oh, my God. You know, when they were trying to discredit breastfeeding.
Yep.
Mm. Oh, that was, at one point, it was almost a taboo.
Well, right, because why? Breastfeeding will ruin the woman's figure, and then they gave him that pill to dry him up, and ain't it amazing that the women who did that are the ones we're supposed to put out pink ribbons for now? I call that karma.
I call it bad science and bad public policy, all in the name of dollars for corporate advancement.
All of the talk about sugar and feeding babies that, and Paul is firstborn got some. I think it's been within 20 years. I thought it was in Iowa, but you know I can be wrong. Some hospital was having massive fatalities in the baby fatalities, and some nurse had used salt instead of sugar in the preparation of those formulas. So. Sue, it ain't been too far back that they were still using sugar, and maybe some places still do.
Yeah. Well, it's a big item outside this country. Nestle makes lots and lots and lots of money selling infant formula in Africa.
I thought at one time they were talking about nature's perfect food, weren't they?
Yeah.
Was milk?
Yes.
Of course, it was pasteurized and homogenized, but
oh,
we could
my
skip
gosh.
That part.
Expose anybody to nastiness.
Well, by the time you pasteurize and homogenize the milk, you are better off nutritionally to drink beer. That's fact. Because it's not, you know, they're by heating it, there's so much of it is rendered inert, it's not digestible.
Well, particularly
anybody on a farm that's seen where you raise the lambs on the ewes or you raise the calf on its mother's milk versus raising it on milk replacer.
Yes.
There's a world of difference. And then, you know, you want to get into some really freaky stuff where this calf milk replacer, for a time, they were using blood products in it. How'd that work out for Canada? That's how they got mad cow disease and everything.
Is that, yeah. Anyway, that's the kind of things that I'm finding here in the Fortune magazine from February 1940. There's an ad here for Royal, the world's number one typewriter. Oh, there's an ad here, Thomas, for Four Roses. Four Roses.
you could advertise whiskey in those magazines. Every drop is whiskey at least 4 years
it
old.
Is. Yeah, it is Four Roses, yes. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anchor Distilleries, Inc., Louisville and Baltimore. Anyway, oh, there's a great big one-page ad for Mimeograph. The trademark of the A.B. Dick Company, Chicago. Here's the ad. A brain, a girl, and a typewriter, and you're all set to make and slash or save money with a Mimeograph duplicator.
Yeah. And
don't forget that girl.
Yeah.
Pardon me. Anyway, what they've done in this issue that's dedicated to their survey, Fortune Survey, People of the USA, a self-portrait. In keeping with the rest of this issue, this installment of the survey is dedicated to presenting a view of the people of the USA as a whole. But this is not a journalist's view. It is the people as they see themselves in terms of their personal hopes and fears, their beliefs in the future. If Jean-Jacques Rousseau could have had at hand such findings as these about two centuries ago when he was laying some of the philosophic foundations of the American Revolution, he might well have used them as documentation. For while they do not establish the brotherhood of man itself, they go far in revealing a kinship among all sorts and conditions of men living under a democratic system. And don't forget that girl. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Anyway, so that's what they've done here, this whole issue, and they have several articles dedicated to the various topics that they've split this up into. If I can get to the layout, here it is. The United States of America. In searching for a suitable way for Fortune to commemorate its 10th anniversary, many ideas were examined. In the end, it was felt that nothing could be more suitable than the setting forth of our own experience of the economy that we have been reporting for the past 10 years. This issue, therefore, differs from every other issue of Fortune in that it is a particularly intimate and personal expression. It is, however, an expression of a large and objective reality which must be documented and understood for what it has become, the most important nation in the world. Fortune was founded at the peak of the 1929 boom in the conviction that American industrial life represented an achievement worth recording. But during most of its existence, Fortune has found itself reporting on an economy whose dominant psychology was not one of achievement, but of failure. Now, at last, at the end of a decade, the idea in which Fortune was conceived is ripe, we believe, for reassertion. The reassertion must not be and is here merely and is not here merely emotional. It recognizes and meets the inherent and critical problem, but it recognizes also that the problems of the U.S. are mostly the result of the achievements and that they can be solved only in that light. And so they have these various, the USA, they have an article on industrialization, the 30,000 managers, the workers, the 32 million farmers, the great American salesman, U.S. culture, the U.S. dollar, politics, the dispossessed, the U.S. frontier, and the details of the Fortune Survey. So that's what they have. So I've read a good many of these articles so far, particularly the one on the U.S. dollar. The one on the 32 million farmers is...
you could go to sleep and not miss anything.
Yeah.
I read the one on industrialization, read the one on the dispossessed, and most of the one on the USA. And they've got a lot of numbers and stuff, and charts and pictures. Ooh la la. Anyway, what I was trying to do was pick out some things to compare and contrast the condition in February of 1940. Actually, what I was trying to do was come up with a context for the Raw Materials National Council pamphlet from January 2nd, 1941, which was 11 months later than this Fortune magazine when this was published, and try and put that time period in a little bit of perspective. Because I certainly don't remember it.
Well, here in the Bakken yesterday, oil in the Bakken was $18 flat.
Mm-hmm.
$18 is pretty flat.
Yep, 18 flat. The legislature met on Thursday, opening, and there was comments saying there's been a small dip in oil prices, but it's not going to affect the budgeting. Now, 42% of the taxes collected in North Dakota last year were from oil, and it's all based on the price of oil. And in July, it was $68 a barrel. So I didn't even need a calculator to figure out, you know, that's more than 300% drop.
$50 out of 70.
Yeah. And that doesn't affect anybody?
Well, but wow. You've got to understand that political speech, what they're saying is, it's not going to affect the budget. They're going to spend the money anyway.
Yeah, well, the guy yesterday, the commodities expert, the resident commodities expert here was on, and I called Randy right after it because I thought I was going to throw up. The decline in the price of oil isn't because we're pumping a lot more. Mm-hmm. It's first, the high price, the high dollar is really harmful.
On the international trade,
there's an anticipation that we're going to start producing a lot more oil and demand will shrink. Hasn't happened, but it's perceived that it's coming.
Right. Well, now, no, demand will stay the same. Might grow a little bit, but it won't grow as much as production. And so we'll wind up increasing our inventories. And everybody knows that having oil in inventory is a terrible idea.
Well, also, it sounded just like grain. The price of oil declined massively. And we've increased production huge since July. Well, it's because it's there, they can pump it. But, you know, it takes more barrels to produce the same amount of money.
Well, you know why, too.
That's like
Iranians
farming.
And the Iraqis oil. And the Saudis out of the oil business.
Yep.
Well, they're not quite saying that, but, the thought is if your price goes down, the only way to maintain income is to increase the volume.
Well, not according to
you.
That's it.
Yeah.
You know, if your price goes down, your gross income's to maintain your gross income, you have to have more volume.
Yeah, but you're not thinking the way the monopolist does.
Well, I'm not thinking the way economists do and the experts either.
No.
I'm just thinking the what happens out here in the field
when you have your hands
in the dirt.
The international situation is the one that the government has been taken over by the oil interests, and they dance to that tune. Right. And that's what's going on, is that the monopolist mentality says, just like the head of Phelps Dodge did when copper was at, 60 cents, and the break-even price was 62 cents, and the reporter asked him, wouldn't you like to see copper at least go up to 65 cents?
And the head of Phelps Dodge says, hell no, I'd like to see it go to 55 cents. And the reporter was just, he was just stupefied. And he says, well, what's that going to get you? And Phelps Dodge, president, says, well, that means that I can then buy up all the other copper companies for cents on the dollar and then set whatever goddamn price I want. And that's exactly it's an aspect of the same attitude is going on here now.
I was thinking about it as a national security issue or a community issue, the allowance of the price of oil to go from 68 to 18 should not be tolerated because it affects the lives of the people here in our state and our state government. We need the revenue.
Right.
The BTUs in that barrel of oil didn't change.
Nope.
To allow that to happen is bad public policy.
Yes, it is. It's bad economic policy. But
yeah, well, it's harmful. I mean, yes, I got gas at the pump at $2.19. Randy's is much cheaper because we have too much oil close by.
Yeah, and we don't have oil. Well, we used to have oil fields here, but now we don't. I think the closest refinery is it's in Indiana, it's east of Gary, Indiana.
But we bring our oil back from Indiana, Illinois. We only refine a tiny fraction of the oil that's produced here.
There is a refinery in Duluth, Minnesota, by the way.
Yeah, we have a pipeline.
Well, I don't know if they got that up and running. They kind of blew that up last summer.
Oh, did they?
Yeah. Remember me telling you about that?
Oh, vaguely.
Yeah, they kind of blew that up, and I ain't really heard a whole lot about it since.
Oh, okay. Supposedly it was up there so that they could fuel those ships. They were cracking, I guess they run most of them on diesel now. They used to run on what was called bunker oil.
There's still some running on bunker. That's number 6 burner.
Yeah. Stuff that you got to heat it up before you can pump it.
Has to be heated. Yeah, it has to be heated in the tank.
It's like tar.
Yeah. Yeah, on one of the ships my son was on, they were using bunker fuel. Because it was so cheap.
Yep. A buddy of mine up here that runs the mint fields used to fire his boiler. Well, I guess he still does. Fires his boiler on bunker fuel.
It's way more heat per unit of bunker fuel than diesel fuel.
Yeah.
5 or 6 times, I think.
Yep.
I mean, it's just huge. A lot of the old hospitals around here were all fueled with bunker fuel when they were converting from coal.
Well,
they had to haul it in and heat at tank cars.
That's correct. It was also associated with military use because a lot of the Navy ran on bunker fuel.
Yes. Yep, those old, big old diesel ships ran on bunker fuel.
And I think the Air Force picked up some of that stuff, so if you got military establishments in your state, then there's probably a fairly easier availability of bunker fuel than would otherwise be there.
Tom, you need to remember that as we look toward the year 2050 and whatever the astronomically large human population will be on this earth, we have to make sure that we can keep up the production of oil to even higher levels so that we've got everyone on the earth has adequate fuel to drive their vehicles.
That's true, and we're going to have to increase food supply too.
Well, that's what always going to happen. Yeah, food and fuel.
I mean, that's why you got to gear up for that, Wendell.
That's right. You're right. We got to start right now.
I thought you were already feeding the world, Wendell.
Well, yeah, that's what I thought too. In the background of this, somewhere, some ag economist said, we sure need a big crop 2019. So I can say the same thing for oil, I guess.
Right.
Or any raw material, you know, your choice.
Yeah, that's right. Pick one. Fill in the blank.
Yep. Yep.
Hey, Randy, or anybody else, read that article I sent out on, talked about the GM strike at Lordstown.
I read it. I didn't. I did not.
No, I haven't either. Well, I have been sort of missing, so.
I found it a fascinating article, and I think it explained a lot. And I wasn't familiar with it, but I knew, you know, talked about the Vega, where they built the Vegas and stuff, and how GM went to robotics and pushing the line is to its capacity and the capacity of people, servicing it and things, and how that broke down. And
I worked in the automotive industry, 100 cars an hour or whatever, that's outrageous.
Right, exactly.
When was that Lordstone thing?
It's like 71, 72 or something?
Somewhere in there, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. There was this one guy, and he was like the son of, you know, like, I don't know, the GM, you know, royalty or something, and he was just a total, you know,
muscle
pusher type guy, and so they were talking about, you know, how, you know, the Corolla and the Bug were coming in and stuff, and so they felt the only way they can compete with the Japs and everybody else was to automate. And so they brought in, you know, they spent a lot of money on robotics, and I guess probably, you know, for welding chassis and stuff like that. And then basically the line was like really moving real fast, and there was, you know, basically you had one job, and you basically had to do that job in like 60 seconds or 30 seconds.
They had it all timed out, sure. Yep.
Yeah, it was all timed out.
Yep.
And so they were building the Vega there, and there was no quality control. I mean, in fact, they were firing guys left and right, you know, and it was also the youngest plant workforce in the nation. I think the average age was like 24. You had a lot of, Vietnam vets,
yeah,
and long hairs and that type of thing. And, they just sort of like went through men like, whatever, you know. And, but the, you know, the whole, and it's an interesting sort of overview of the article, because it's talking about, you know, that I think the title is that the layoffs that that GM is happening and things like this. This goes back to, you know, way back then. It's a sort of corporate philosophy. And at one point they said the amount they spent on robotics and other things, they could have just bought out right out Toyota and,
yeah,
and
yeah,
their competitors, and they would have,
they would have, and then they had to deal with the workers who were probably somewhat better trained in quality in,
right,
the Japanese,
right,
plants.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what they were saying. You know, they were, in fact, there was in the article they mentioned, I guess the HEW, or no, some secretary under labor secretary under Nixon, who they had done some study, and they were actually, it was very progressive, and it was actually looking towards that type of thing, that how labor was treated and stuff. And they said, like, you know, but then, you know, Nixon was impeached and everything else, and this thing was just totally lost, this whole, you know, deception.
Yeah.
But that strike was very important. It was like a real linchpin type of happening, because it, you know, it was indicative of where, you know, corporate world was going towards and has gone towards, you know. So
well, you know, how how inhumane GM was to their workers, really, in considering them and like that.
Well, right. It's the same story in the meatpacking industry.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's a lot of injuries. You know, they bring in the folks from Mexico to work there. Nobody else could. A lot of physical injuries, you know, high-speed packing. And
well, labor.
To the point where, you know, during the Clinton administration, they come out and says, all right, we're going to change the rules and we're going to allow X amount of fecal material on the carcasses because of the high-speed processing.
Well, once we've regarded labor as a commodity,
well, it's a cost item in the balance sheet.
The impact can be measured sociologically. You've wrecked communities because we don't value the person next to us contribution to our society at all. We've dismissed it, discounted it. If you know, anybody who hasn't had any representation in the labor force has been screwed since then. I was just visiting with my daughter today about teacher salaries here, and locally they've sort of kept up, and they have methods and stuff. But in the 2007 meltdown, I think she'd been teaching 10 years. They lost 50% of their teacher retirement fund in that crash. Actually, it was 55%. Disappeared, you know. It just went away. It was just last year that they got back to where they were in 2007.
Right.
And since this latest crash, that's eaten up in the teacher retirement fund, and it's locked in. That's a dedicated fund, and they contract with one of these giant outfits to manage it, and somebody makes a shitload of money, but the concern for the retirement of teachers is just not there. So nobody cares. And then other people, well, they're paid too damn much in the first place.
If you're going to go play the stock market, you can't complain if you're going to lose money when you sit down at the casino table. Because that's the way the game is rigged.
It's a crap game.
It's a gambling thing. You know, you can't go in there with something you're going to expect to have and figure it's a guaranteed return. That's my one attempt at the class on economics. That's the first thing he said. You know, you play the stock market. Don't do that with anything more than the money you take into a casino.
Right.
Don't play with money you can't afford to lose.
Yep.
But most of the stock market today, the vast, vast majority is institutional trades. I mean, the individual is really not in the stock market, you know.
Yeah, but it's still their money.
Yes, because they put it in their pension funds, and the fund companies go and put it on the stock market.
Pure folly that we think it's secure, and we all want to. Anybody's got a retirement fund, they want it to make a lot of money. You know, because you're concerned, you retire and won't have enough to retire on. So you need it to make a lot of money.
But I think the other thing is, where else would the pension funds invest it?
Why do they have to?
That's a good point.
I mean, what you put into the pension fund as earned income as part of your wages, you earn. What you would gain in the stock market is not earned capital. You didn't make that money. You made that by cheating somebody else.
Well, our biggest investor-owned utilities here is Montana Dakota Utilities. They have made so much money, they were regarded, they're still in one of the top 100 managed
stock companies in America, according to whoever checks that. That's a pretty good position with multiples of thousands. They're the largest sand and gravel company in Hawaii and in California. They have endless subsidiaries, all done out of the money they've made here selling electricity and gas. And they, you know, they're guaranteed about a 12.5% return here on their investment. Mm-hmm. Well, they have dividends every year. Now, I don't object to companies paying dividends, but to think you're going to get rich by that stock escalating, that's the folly, in the market.
Right.
They should be a profitable company and make money on the investment. Sort of like agriculture should.
Yeah. So, there's a difference between that model and the model that you've got.
Yeah, absolutely. It's but most people want to be in on the one that makes the most money.
Sure. Well, right.
I want to be able to beat Bruce, you know.
Yeah. But then the other thing is that much of the activity is mergers and acquisitions and other plays within this, and nice big loans for those mergers, and you know, changing the balance sheets, and so it's all destiny, it's debt structuring and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's as we move the country into finance capitalism.
That's right. You know, and all that is just another. Ponzi scheme or casino engagement with the expected future values. That's all it is.
Right.
So when Sue talks about, where else you're going to invest it, the question is, whose money is it to invest?
You're getting into a pretty sensitive area there, Mr. Cook.
Most of the people who try to invest it think that it belongs to this company or this fund or that depositor or this depositor. Well, damn it, we know better than that. The money belongs to the community. In this case, the United States of America. It is United States of America money.
Can't run a system the way we're running and have that be true.
You know? That's right. No,
it can't be done unless we choose something else to monetize to run our economy, and that's the real issue. What are we going to monetize? And I don't care what it is, but what are we going to choose to monetize to run our economy? And we've chosen debt.
Mm-hmm.
And it works. For some, it's like Randy and I were talking earlier, the movement of money into fewer and fewer hands really can't be stopped under these conditions.
No. It's a characteristic of the system that we have.
Yeah, it can't be, you can't change tax code and change that transfer from the wealth from the people that do the work to the people that are the elite class here
in charge.
It's going to keep going. Will it go until ultimately it's all owned by one person? Well, not likely.
Yeah,
they'll come out before that. That's the question today, what will make them come out. They should have come out a long time ago. So the stuff you read, Randy, when Wilkin went to talk to the Merck, or the Board of Trade,
that
really reflected. He knew that they were a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And they are.
He also knew that they were not particularly interested in hearing what he was going to say.
Well, no, it'd be like me listening to vegetarians. Or people that say that what you need to do is get rid of all the cattle on the globe because they're poisoning the atmosphere. We're not going to have a very long conversation.
Yeah, this is from 1938. This is a question from, this is an open question and answer session with Carl Wilkin. It says, I understand you are meeting with some success with big businessmen. And Mr. Wilkins said, some, yes. And you have another group. For example, I had a meeting with the board of directors of the Chicago Board of Trade on this very program that we have. Here is what I told them. I said, now, if you can't operate on a margin of 1 cent a bushel, let's make it 2, 3, 4, or 5, but handle actual grain.
Ooh,
we do that with livestock. We don't sell steers on the future market. We don't sell automobiles on the future market. We don't sell dress goods on the future market. We sell actual cattle, actual hogs. Why not sell actual bushels?
Actually, they do the hogs and the cattle now.
Yes,
now,
we do.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, we've gone the other direction.
Well, we weren't doing it then. In 1940, that wasn't happening.
That's correct.
That's fairly new. Just like milk.
You know, and I don't know, is it a futures market? When Walmart comes in and sets the price, they're going to pay the companies to provide them product. You know, they set the price ahead of time. This is what we're going to pay you.
Right. Well, how about your wool? Is that a future?
I don't even want to go there.
Is that a futures market?
That could
not even a
toilet
market.
Well, they never did the sheep thing, so I don't know. They just didn't have.
Well, they took care of that the other way, you know. When they changed the rules, well, that was in the 70s. And entire shiploads of live lambs were coming into the West Coast from New Zealand and Australia because you could import the live critter for slaughter and not have it be in the import tariffs and protocols. And it only took about one season, and it wrecked the lamb market forever. It never recovered.
Right.
Paul, I think you should vertically integrate. Paul's woven woolen.
Well, that's a process. Wool is an elaborate, expensive item, and there are very few wool processors left in this country.
What you need to
I'll
do,
buy
of course,
yourself.
Is marry 3 or 4 more wives, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like that worked really well.
When were there wool processes in this country? When was that?
Pardon?
When were there wool processes in this country where were we generating the wool here?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You had, you know, the finished product, you go down to the Carolinas and Georgia where they were making carpet and they were using up the wool. And there was wool processing plants to supply that to them. You know, most of the wool that is produced now is being shipped to China.
Yep.
And now it's so cheap.
Well, not very far from where our ranch was in Belpouche, South Dakota. That was the largest primary wool handling center in America. Ooh. At Belpouche, South Dakota.
Is that when... Was that when in this country we had the we still had the clothing manufacturers in this country?
Yes,
yep, right.
Yep.
Sure, yeah.
And not
now we just wear
fibers.
T-shirts.
Yeah, the synthetic fibers crowded out the demand for wool, which truly it did. But you know, but we had a market for lamb and. That's just diminished now to almost nothing.
Right. Yeah. It's a niche market.
Yeah, there's just not enough sheep left in this country to pay any attention to, or goats. You know, and they both had value.
If we go Muslim, we'll be back in sheep and goats.
Yeah, well, and the goats, the leather off of goats was pretty highly prized.
Yeah.
There was things that were good, but, you know, like in our part of the world, they were a very healthy contribution to the ecosystem.
Right.
The old smart ranchers had cows, and sheep were following the cows because they would graze on grasses and forbs that cows wouldn't eat, and they were companions. It's just, but the management is all... that started changing in the 60s pretty radically. And there's none of that left. It's an industry that's, you know, in the Inner Mountains, there's sheep and Basque sheep herders.
Well, my sister has a flock of sheep.
How many does she have, Randy?
I think they've still got about 300 ewes.
Oh, that's a pretty good little band. Yeah,
yeah, she's older than I am. So.
Well, see, if Paul starts processing wool, then she can take her wool to Paul.
You know what he's doing, Randy? Watch. He's angling for a job as an economic development specialist.
I got the degree. I got the degree, Tom.
Good night,
folks. Good night.
Good night. Oh, my. Well, so it goes. Well, I have to go, too. So, yeah, it's been fun. Happy New Year, everyone.
Happy New Year.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.